listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear from a Milwaukee man who's working to connect fellow veterans with the land and with other ecologically sound enterprises.
Now, buying your first home is still seen as a big milestone for many people. You get to make the space your own through decorating, painting, small remodeling projects maybe, but there's a lot of things new homeowners don't know to expect and often don't know how to handle.
From leaky faucets to squirrels in the walls, this can all be new, mystifying, and overwhelming. But across the nation, different colleges and housing nonprofits are creating classes to try to better equip new owners.
We want to hear from you. If you're a seasoned homeowner, what do you wish you'd known or thought about when first moving into your house? Have you gotten to the point where you can do some, most, all of your own repairs?
Or if you're a new homeowner, what problems have you encountered and how did you deal with them? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
Jason Hafeman is the outreach manager at Project Home and has been with the Madison nonprofit since 2009. Jason's also responsible for planning and scheduling Project Home's free home maintenance classes, which include things like basic household plumbing, cost-effective energy improvements, and how to prevent basement flooding. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, how overwhelming is that new first house for a lot of homeowners who are taking the plunge for the first time?
It is very overwhelming because you go through the whole process of getting financing and it's exciting. And you're trying to find the right house. And then you get done with all of that and you walk in and you have no idea what most things are. That's the way most people approach it. I mean, I remember my first house. It was a 1920s home. Great bones to the structure, but no insulation in the walls, very under-insulated in the attic. It was freezing cold in the winter, overly hot in the summer, and some other challenges as well. So they don't give you a manual, unfortunately, when you buy a house.
Now, you run classes at Project Home in Madison. We were seeing in the New York Times people who are able to afford housing in New York, they're looking for classes too. There seems like a demand for this kind of information.
I think so. I mean, it's really important at least to know the basics of general maintenance and just an understanding of where your mechanicals are in your home, where your water heater is, where your furnace is, what are the main triggers for those things. Like a lot of times there's a dedicated outlet or switch for a furnace, for a water heater. And if that gets flipped, it's as simple as flipping the switch back to make it work again. And other people don't realize that. And they call a technician to come out. They get charged for it. And all it was a simple flip of a switch. So knowing those basic things, including your electrical box, those are really important to start.
A good starting point, at least for me in the past, is usually when you buy a house, you get it inspected. And that inspection report is kind of a nice blueprint to start with. Is that something that you recommend people do?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's pretty standard. People do inspections now whenever purchasing a home. It is important. Obviously, it doesn't catch everything. And if you're a homeowner, you know once you get into it, you learn kind of the quirks and the special features of your home, right? But every house, there's something. And there's always maintenance to do it, no matter how new it is, how old it is. But I think having a basic understanding of building science, how insulation works, how your heating system works and those type of things. And then just some general spring and fall maintenance can really make a big difference as we approach the fall season. And then as we get out of the winter season, like things to look for with your gutter cleaning, with things around the foundation, looking for areas water can enter, air can enter. Those are important things to just kind of keep an eye on.
Oh, that's a good timely place to start digging into specifics now. Mm-hmm. For that person who's in their first fall season, give us a walkthrough of what we should be doing.
So a lot of it is looking around the exterior. So walk around the exterior of your home, look to see if and this is where a lot of the basement flooding comes in from rainwater, not the kind of epic flooding we're talking about that we've experienced around waterways, but when you have just general rain and you get water in the basement, okay? You want to look for the ground sloping either flat or sloping towards the house. Those are areas you won't need to address, and usually it's pretty simple, just getting some topsoil, filling in, creating a slope to grade away so the water runs away from the house. The other things are looking at your gutters, making sure they're attached, making sure downspout extensions are attached, making sure they're cleaned out. And then look for things like around your dryer vent. Is that clean? That's a thing you should actually do pretty much monthly. Check your dryer vent to make sure that the lint isn't getting clogged up on that exterior port. A lot of people don't even know where that comes out of their house, but if that gets clogged up, that can be a fire hazard. So just getting in there, cleaning the lint out of the end of that every month is important. A lot of people don't do it over the winter months, but if you can get it right before fall, that's a good time to do it.
And a common problem for a lot of people is that minor plumbing problem. And you've got a class on the basics of plumbing. What are some of the things that you recommend people try to figure out how to do for themselves?
Sure. I mean, simple things like changing a faucet, changing a toilet. Once you have a basic understanding of how to do it, maybe the right materials and supplies to use is something that most people can do. Not everybody, but most. And, you know, it hadn't been something I had done until about 5 years ago, my first toilet change. And the only thing I would advise, and I think there was in this New York Times article too, is do your first one on someone else's house, just as a little, but, you know, do it right. But anyway, I did mine on my parents' home. But it was great to understand. And the class we have, that one in particular, is by our plumber. So he knows how to do all kinds of advanced things, but really breaks it down to here are some simple things to do most homeowners can do. And the other challenge that we're seeing right now in the trades and how short-handed everyone is and how busy all the trades workers are is for something simple like that, it would be difficult to get someone to come out to your house to pay them to do it, to even take that job if it's a smaller job. So it may be, as we move forward, something people are going to have to learn to do.
Talking to Jason Hafeman from Project Home. He runs a series of classes for homeowners. We're talking about Homeowners 101, the stuff you need to know when you get that first house. You mentioned energy conservation. Talk about that insulation that wasn't there in your first house. What are some good basics, again, with winter coming up that we can tackle maybe as a do-it-yourself project?
Yeah, so looking first in your attic. A lot of people don't look in your attic, but annually you should look in there. At least poke your head up through the attic hatch, find out where that is, and just look around. Look at the underside of the roof deck so you don't see any staining or active leaks or signs of that. And then just kind of checking your insulation levels is really important. And you can do that with a tape measure right by the attic hatch and see what kind of levels you have. Generally, for our climate, you want to have about 12 to 14 inches of insulation minimum in your attic. And if you have, you know, we've been in attics where there's 2 inches of insulation, and those are highly under-insulated. You can go certainly more than that. You can go all the way up to probably about 20 inches and still receive a good benefit from that insulation. But attic insulation is the key to maintaining a good temperature in your house in the wintertime.
Can you talk about what kind of difference that can make on a heating bill?
Oh, it's huge, you know, because the way the heat leaves most homes is through the ceiling space into the attic space and out. So the more you can do, and it kind of works together, you also need to look at air sealing. And this is why kind of weatherizing homes has become a bit more of a science than it used to be, because we have to actually test and find out where the air is leaking and stop those quick air leaks, which is usually around light fixtures, where wall plates come together, where any electrical or plumbing penetrations go through the ceiling into the attic space. That's where quick air leaks out. And if you have an older home and you have a big chimney going through there, normally those chimney chases are huge air leakers. So it's sealing up those air leaks first, which you can do with the caulk sometimes or expandable foam. Chimneys are a little trickier, but there's a process for that. And then adding insulation on top of that, that's where you get maximum benefit. It helps maintain the heat in the house, and then you've got a warmer home.
What are some of the other most common questions you run into with that first-time homeowner?
We hear, you know, questions across the board. And that's one of the things we were talking about our class series today a bit, is that one of the most beneficial parts of it, we have content, we put together a topic, but the biggest part is people bring their personal questions for their house, and we can answer those questions. And each house is different, and each house works differently. So when you have that one-on-one time, and we can bring up a scenario, and then usually, even though it may be a little different at someone else's house, they experience something similar. We could all learn from each other in those classes. That's why we love it. But man, we just hear questions across the board. How do I fix this? What about my siding? What about my windows? How do I deal with my furnace? And we try to get people at least to have some base knowledge. So even if they can't do things themselves and they're hiring the work, they know the right questions to ask a contractor, so they hire the right contractor.
Now, some people are naturally handy, or they grew up doing this kind of stuff. More power to them. That's not me. Do you think some people are kind of shy to want to ask for help? Like, I don't want to look dumb. Everybody should know how to do this basic thing.
Absolutely. I think there's kind of that sort of perception that everyone should have this base knowledge of things, but reality is they don't. And so that's one thing we have nice with our staff and any of our classes. If you come out, there's not a dumb question. We will answer any question, and we'll spend as much time as you need to get you kind of feeling comfortable. And we also try to just communicate to people that, look, if you're not comfortable taking on this big of a project, that's where you hire a professional. But certain things, simple maintenance, basic items, are things you can learn to do and should feel comfortable doing.
How has the internet changed this kind of thing? Because I personally have had, how am I supposed to clean the filter on this faucet? How do I take this? I can look online and find it, or I can learn that, oh, this is a job that is beyond my skills. I need to hire somebody for that.
Absolutely. There are great resources, you know, on the internet in terms of, you know, videos, how-to videos and other things. And, you know, I think it comes down to your comfort level in the end. You know, how comfortable do you feel watching a video and then digging into something? I think you learn anytime with any type of house project, if it starts to become a little bigger than a simple exchange of a faucet or something, there can be a lot more to it. And you can find yourself with a big project or a bigger project than you're anticipating.
That said, it sounds like you're encouraging people to at least think about it and maybe give it a shot. So for the people who do want to do that, give us a little toolkit. What kind of things do we want to make sure we have around the house for those basic projects?
Yeah, I mean, basic hand tools are really important. Screwdrivers, a flathead screwdriver, Phillips head. Also having a hammer, having a screw gun, a drill bits. You know, those are some basic items that can go a long way. The plumbing, there are some pretty specialty tools for plumbing that can really make things easier. But having a basic plumber's wrench and some of those kind of things are really handy. It can let you tackle most projects. So, you know, that's mostly it. Kind of the general hand tools you'd think of, a few power tools. You don't have to go extreme, but those things will get you a long way.
And do you know, you're in Madison, working in the Madison area. Are there classes like this? Are there other nonprofits around the state that teach these kind of classes?
I'm not aware of other nonprofits outside of our region doing this at this point. You know, Project Home is based out of Madison. We work in Dane and Greene County, and so we do things here. But we do, you know, we have been trying to record more of the presentations and put them out there online on our YouTube channel as well to make them available when possible. And so we're hopeful to continue that, at least to share information that way.
And that's the Project Home YouTube channel?
Yeah, Project Home WI, and you can find us.
Great. Jason, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Jason Hafeman joined us in our studio. He's the outreach manager at Project Home, a Madison nonprofit. He plans and schedules Project Home's free home maintenance classes, which include basic household plumbing, cost-effective energy improvements, and how to prevent basement flooding. We talked with him about what to know when you first become a homeowner.
Coming up, a Milwaukee veteran is working to help others who have left the military to heal through urban agriculture. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, if the only personal mail you've received all year was a few birthday cards and too many baby shower invites, then it might be refreshing to receive a handwritten letter once in a while. Our next guest says snail mail feels good to get and maybe even better to give.
Now, a project in Milwaukee is working to help veterans transition back to civilian life and to support them as they recover from physical or emotional wounds.
Brian Sales is Deputy Director for Groundwork Milwaukee and founder of the Green Veterans Program. A combat veteran who served over 9 years in the U.S. Army Infantry with one tour in Kosovo and two in Iraq, Brian worked for and was mentored by Will Allen at Growing Power in Milwaukee. And he was also instrumental in the passage of the Wisconsin Veterans Bill in 2017. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So how did Green Veterans come about?
So the concept for Green Veterans started while I was in college studying alternative and renewable energy management. My military background combined with my newfound passion for sustainability led me to start questioning, why isn't anyone teaching vets about sustainability? You know, it's a rapidly progressing industry that is growing and advancing every day. So after learning that there was no program leading the charge, Green Veterans was born.
And so what are the issues you're trying to address by tailoring these programs to veterans?
So in 2017, Green Veterans became a part of Groundwork Milwaukee, allowing it to reach a much larger network, access to greater resources, and impact many more veterans. So Green Veterans supports the mission of Groundwork Milwaukee by empowering people in our community to promote environmental, economic, and social well-being. Through the program supported by Groundwork, Green Vets encourages holistic health through experiential learning in urban agriculture. So we leverage a lot of urban gardening and urban ag as part of our horticultural therapy for trauma resolution with PTSD.
So, Brian, we just commemorated the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One earlier this month. And you say that connecting soldiers to the land has been used, at least since that conflict, as a form of therapy. Why do you think agriculture is a good way to help veterans with the transition back to civilian life?
Like you said, you know, as far back as World War One, nature and farming has been used to treat the invisible wounds of war. Today, veterans continue to face the challenges of reintegration, and the Green Veterans Program provides opportunities for healing by horticulture. We've seen firsthand that touching soil is an antidepressant, so we are leveraging urban gardening as an alternative therapy for people managing PTSD and other related trauma disorders.
Is there something to the fact that you're producing something that it's not just a one-off, like, oh, I'm going to go, you know, dig a hole in the dirt or, you know, something like, or even cut the grass or something, but you're actually watching something that you're nurturing grow and then eventually nourish either yourself or your family or members of the community?
Sure. Yeah, it's such a grateful thing to experience, you know, growing from seed where you bury it and then you see it come up to a little plant, and then that plant produces, you know, food to nurture people and to heal people. It's just a great feeling to have.
Of the veterans that you are working with, coming in contact with through Green Vets, I'm guessing that a fair number of them might never have had any experience with growing things, with gardening, with farming. What is it like introducing fellow veterans to that kind of work?
It's actually pretty surprising how many of them like it, because it's a very active activity to do. There's always something new. You know, you always have to take care of your plant. You always have to cultivate your soil. You know, if you see that your plants are being eaten by pests, you know, you automatically start asking questions like, how do I remediate that so that I could save my plant? So there's so much things that goes into agriculture that veterans like, and it kind of resonates some of the activities, the things that we used to do in the military.
Hmm. I'm guessing that a lot of these urban garden plots are not being cultivated exclusively by the veterans that you're working with, but they're probably gardening next to members of the community, people who might have very different life experiences than they have had. Is that part of the healing as well, being part of this larger community that's all tending a piece of land?
Right. Well, with Groundwork, you know, that's one of the missions that we have, is that our Milwaukee Grows Network. You know, we help manage and established over 100 community gardens in Milwaukee. And as far as the veterans program that we did this year, we just mainly focused on one project as a proof of concept. So we mainly did all of our activities over on 33rd and Wells, over at the Vets Place Central facility. They have a pretty large community garden in the back, and that's where we did majority of our organic therapy project this season.
Brian Sales is a combat veteran who served over 9 years in the U.S. Army Infantry. He's deputy director for Groundwork Milwaukee and founder of the Green Veterans Program. And Brian, you yourself have been diagnosed with service-related PTSD. What has helped you most in your recovery and transition back to civilian life?
You know, I think what helped me most is that I found myself going from an organized, planned, team dynamic, and structured chaos with little transitional support when I came out. In other words, the military turned me from a civilian into soldiers, but upon returning, I was not turned from a soldier back to civilian. And that was pretty overwhelming. You know, like many others, my initial post-war employment experiences left me without sense of purpose. I went from the most important mission in the U.S. to facing jobs that had no meaning when I got out. And then finally, when I went back to school, that's when my experiences there led me to create the Green Vets. And then from there, you know, I found a new mission, a new sense of purpose, and a renewed commitment to service, and ultimately a passion for farming. That's why urban farming and sustainability as a whole gave me a purpose, again, after the military.
You talked about other aspects of sustainability, too, besides the agriculture and the farming. What other opportunities is Green Vets able to provide for people returning from combat?
So here in Groundwork Milwaukee's Green Vets program, we mainly focus on horticulture therapy and trauma resolution to urban ag. Other Green Vets chapters, specifically in Florida, they're focusing more on green building, energy efficiencies, and renewable energies. So as you can see, we're focused on different aspects of sustainability. And, you know, eventually, as we evolve our program here in Milwaukee, we'd like to also get into energy efficiencies and renewable energies because I see the city of Milwaukee going in that direction.
And Brian, as we wrap up, if there's a veteran listening who feels like he or she could benefit from being involved in Green Veterans, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
The best way for them to connect with us is just go to our website. It's www.groundworkmke.org, and just look up the Green Vets program. Also, if you guys would like to get in contact with me, just go under staff. You'll see my contact information on our website.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for telling us about Green Veterans and for sharing what it's done for you and others.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Brian Sales is a combat veteran who served over 9 years in the U.S. Army Infantry. He's Deputy Director for Groundwork Milwaukee and founder of the Green Veterans Program.
Coming up after the news, a look at the joys of snail mail. I'm Rob Farrad.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farrad. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, find out about great events in your area, and get the latest from the WPR News Department.
Now, if it seems like the only thing being delivered through the mail lately is Amazon packages and bills, you might not be too far off. According to the U.S. Postal Service's own data, the number of first-class mail items has dropped by more than 50% in the last decade.
To put that another way, the average American household only receives 10 pieces of personal mail a year, aside from holiday cards and invitations. Our next guest says, amidst all the text messaging, emailing, and Facebook posting, we might benefit from sending some snail mail.
We want to hear from you. Do you still send letters and postcards to people? Do you receive them yourself? Do you think it feels different or more valued than sending a text message or an email? Did you have a pen pal when you were younger? And do you think you'd like to have one now? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
Susan Shane is a freelance writer and traveler who's been published in the Washington Post, NPR, and more. She wrote the piece, "We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now," for the New York Times. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, are you a letter writer yourself?
I am. I mean, I've always been a huge fan of postcards, cards, letters, anything like that. So I do try to write as many cards as I can. Letters, like long letters by themselves, I haven't been writing as many of those lately.
Do you feel like a rare breed in a world of email and texting?
I do. I mean, I do think that cards stand out these days, especially amongst people my age. I'm a millennial, so I wasn't a digital native. I grew up writing cards and letters to my family who live far away. But especially amongst people my age, we now just turn to text messages and emails and Facebook messages. So I do think that I'm a bit rare in that.
And when you send somebody a card or a letter, are they surprised?
Yeah, I often get, you know, I mean, the funny thing is I often get a text back that says, like, oh, my God, thank you so much for the card. It was such a fun surprise to come home to, because I think we're all so used to opening the mailbox and finding nothing but ads and bills. And when you see a little envelope sticking out there with handwriting on it, it just makes your day.
Yeah, I think back, I actually went through the box of correspondence that I had that my parents still had for some reason, and I realized in high school, man, I wrote a lot of letters back in those days, and they were all pretty boring, I think, but it really completely fell off my radar. Why do you think, is it just the technology, or have we changed? What happened?
I think it's just easier. We think it's easier to, you know, just shoot off an email or shoot off a text. But I've actually found that sending cards is actually not that hard. You just have to take a few steps to make it be as easy as email, and then you might do it more.
And when you're composing, does it feel different? Does it feel more meaningful when you're actually writing something by hand as opposed to typing or you know, putting it on your phone?
I do think so, because for one thing, you can't delete. I mean, I personally don't have any whiteout on me, and so if I write something, it's probably staying. So I think a little bit harder about what I'm going to write. And I also know that this might be something that somebody keeps for a while, whereas an email, they're just going to read it, maybe reply, and then archive it. A card might be something they put on their bulletin board or that they read over every few years.
Talking to Susan Shane, a writer. She wrote a piece in the New York Times about the lost art of writing letters and postcards instead of just sending an email or a text. You can join in if you are a letter writer or a former one. We'll go to your calls now. Jude is with us in Iola. Jude, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I feel that now everything is fast. People just want everything quick and fast. And for me, I love going to the mailbox and checking my mail and getting letters, and I also love writing them, because when you write a letter, you put so much more into it because you take the time. And when I receive letters, I can feel what the person has genuinely put into the writing more than I could from, you know, from an email. And I will always be doing that. I will always be looking forward to my mail, and I'll be always ready to just sit down and answer letters and send cards. And I love to put the cards out and just leave them out so I can look at them and reread them.
And Jude, do you have people that you actually correspond with? You write them, they write you back and forth?
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Fantastic, Jude. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. And Susan, that idea of, you know, when you read biographies of famous people, they're always writing these awesome letters back and forth. And that's something that a lot of us are just totally missing out on. Not Jude, she's doing it, but a lot of us don't have that, Susan.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said in my story, you know, there's that famous website, or nowadays famous website, called Letters of Note, that kind of has all these intimate letters of people throughout history. And I just don't think that emails of note has the same ring, you know, because it's so exciting to see what somebody's handwriting looked like and what kind of paper they were using, and to see those ink smudges in there. I mean, that's what makes it real. And when it's just on a computer, it just doesn't seem as much of an intimate glimpse into their lives.
Thanks for calling in, Jude. And Jude also mentioned, Susan, that anticipation, like you're going to the mail and there could be something cool in there. And I got to say, when I hear the mail fall in, we've got a mail slot. When I hear the mail fall in, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, maybe there's something cool there. And there isn't, because I don't write letters. I don't get letters. So I know it's going to be advertising circulars and, you know, the utility bill or something like that. Is that part of the fun, knowing that, hey, something cool might be there?
Exactly. I mean, nobody gets excited when they get an email. An email just means something that you're going to have to work and that you're going to have to think about and reply to. It's something to get through, whereas a piece of mail is really exciting. You can look at it. You can cherish it. There's no rush to reply because somebody's waiting on you. You can take your time like Jude did and really think about what you want to say.
Let's go to another caller now. Sue is with us in Cassville. Sue, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy writing letters, postcards, probably write 4 or 5 a week, and actually have a pen pal that is a former coworker that corresponds with me and keeps me up to date what's going on with her life. It's like getting a present in the mail, like you were saying, like today there was a postcard from her, and it just kind of slows down the day for me. Sit down and take in what she shared, and it's really a great pleasure.
Fantastic, Sue. Thank you so much for sharing with sharing that with us. And Susan, both Sue and Jude mentioned something, the idea of life being really fast, the letter writing and reading as a way to slow down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about the last time you sat down to write a card or a letter. I mean, you're going to be taking out a paper, and a lot of people who I spoke to thought about the idea of thinking about the person while you're writing it, you know, picturing their face while you're writing them a letter. And it's kind of a really beautiful moment to take that time out of your busy day and sit there and really give yourself over to this person while you're writing a card or a letter.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, in your piece, you wrote about some kind of famous people who are still letter writers. And you mentioned a public radio favorite, the author David Sedaris. What did he have to say about writing letters?
Oh, yeah. It was so fun to talk to him. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his writing. And so knowing that he was really into letters, he spoke to me. And I mean, obviously, he was very funny. So I was laughing the whole time. But yeah, he loves writing letters. He writes them to all of his fans. He writes them to his boyfriend. And I thought this was really interesting. He writes them to everybody that he works with on a book tour. So if at a bookstore, if there's people who are helping him get set up, he writes them a letter. And he basically said, nobody else does that. And he just said it's really classy. Real mail is classy, and he likes to be thought of as classy. And when he receives real mail from people, it's meaningful to him. And so he sends it back.
Let's bring on another caller now. Karen is with us in La Crosse. Karen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to add, I do think it's very special when these days, especially, to get a card in the mail that's handwritten. I keep cards that are special to me. I still have cards from my grandparents, you know, from before email existed yet. And every once in a while, I'll look through those and see the handwritten notes that they sent to me with their signatures on them. And it's just a very warm feeling to remember them that way and to see their own penmanship.
And are these things you're going to hang on to for a long time, a little family mementos maybe?
Oh, yeah. My kids will have to, you know, clean that out someday when I die.
That's their problem. Karen, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Though, I mean, if those kids keep it, I mean, this is pure gold for people who decide to get into genealogy and family history, Susan. So that might be a reason to save, especially some of those older, more special cards, especially from people who have passed on.
Yeah, I mean, you can really get a glimpse into their personality and see what they were thinking about, and it wouldn't be so filtered and edited as perhaps an email would. And besides, nobody's printing out emails and putting them into a scrapbook. You know, my kids aren't going to have emails that I wrote when I was in my 20s or 30s.
We're talking to Susan Shane, freelance writer. She wrote the piece, "We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now," for the New York Times.
And we want to hear from you. Do you still send letters and postcards to people? What about that process do you enjoy? If you don't send letters or cards, what holds you back? How do you feel when you get a handwritten letter? Or can you even remember the last time you got one? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and tell us.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Susan Shane, freelance writer and traveler who wrote the piece, "We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now," for the New York Times.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think we've lost something in a time when almost all of our communications are digital? Are you interested in getting back in the habit of writing letters and postcards? Who would you choose to write to first? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a snail mail letter and tell us what you're thinking.
Back to your calls now. Coco is with us in Wisconsin. Coco, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I hadn't written a letter in a really, really long time. I used to write letters all the time when I lived overseas. But my son has joined the Air Force, and that's the only way I can communicate. So I am writing letters, and all of our family members are writing letters. And oddly enough, we're now writing letters back and forth to each other, all of us.
Wow. So that got you started in writing everybody.
It did.
And what's that like?
Because I wanted to make sure everybody knew. You know, it's therapeutic. It's very therapeutic.
Coco, thanks a lot for calling in. Susan, what do you think? Does it feel therapeutic sometimes to write a letter?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not just anecdotal. So in the story, I referred to a study that somebody did at Kent State University, and he found that writing letters actually, the writing letters of gratitude, they could write to anybody, the content just had to be positive. And with each letter, the writers said they experienced higher levels of happiness and life satisfaction. And the professor who ran the study told me that we all have this base of gratitude inside of us, but we have to tap into it to get its benefits. And he said that letter writing can do that for you. So it sounds like with Coco and her family, that's definitely something that's happening.
Coco, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. Before we go back to our callers, Susan, one thing that might prevent me writing letters. I mean, when I write a card to somebody for an occasion or something, I have writer's block. There's a blank page. What do they care about? I don't know. What do we write about these days?
I mean, that's the thing. I don't think you have to overthink it. I think that might be why some people are nervous about writing letters, but just act like you're talking to the person. Just picture them in your head and write what you would say if they were sitting right there in front of you. Tell them how you feel. Tell them why you're grateful for them, whether they're celebrating something or whether you're sending sympathy. And it doesn't have to be some beautiful masterpiece. Just the act is really what counts.
I can promise it won't be a beautiful masterpiece if I write it. We'll go back to our callers. Jan is with us in Racine. Jan, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I guess I'm different than some people. I write often to people I don't hear back from. An example would be I wrote my godson when he was up in a boot camp. He had gotten into some trouble for drugs, and I wrote him often. I wrote to a Vietnam veteran who was in rehab recovering, and I never heard from her, but I told her she didn't have to. And she came back to me after about a year and was so very, very grateful. I treasure my father and mother's letters that they sent me in college. There's something about seeing their handwriting that just kind of brings them back. I currently write for some people in church who are elderly and can't write back, and also a couple of college students who are away, and they're always interesting. I don't always know what I'm going to write, but it just seems to come to me once I start, you know, start writing something. I think that's the trick to keep going.
Jan, thank you so much for sharing that story. Jan, not expecting to get letters back, and kind of in a lot of those cases, Susan reaching out, offering some maybe consolation or a little connection to people who might not otherwise have it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to expect letters back. I mean, you're definitely going to get some letters back and some cards back. I mean, if you want mail, I always say, you know, you have to send mail. But I mean, I think that's really beautiful that Jan is letting people know how she feels and not necessarily expecting anything back, because she can feel confident that the letters are meaningful to them, even if they're not at the point in their life where they're going to be able to respond.
Jan, thanks a lot for the call. Sharita is with us now in Madison. Sharita, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to, I love the conversation. I think it's really cool because it just kind of made me tap into what my grandma always does. She just turned 70 this year, so she's a little bit hard of hearing pretty early on, I think anyways, but she just loves to get letters in the mail. So I have my 10-year-old daughter write her 25 letters in December so that she gets something Aww. New in the mail every day, and so it's kind of hard to kind of match up the time so that it works out right, but we figured it out, so it works out really good, and she likes to practice her cursive because she loves the way that my grandma writes in cursive, and that's something that they don't really teach in school anymore, so it's a good time for both of them.
Sharita, thank you so much for sharing that sort of an advent calendar of letters. I love it. You know, does it matter if we write in cursive or not, Susan? I would have to do some digging deep to remember how to write that way.
No, I definitely don't think so. I loved what Sharita is doing. I think that sounds like such a beautiful idea. And I think it taps into something else, is that kids love mail and kids love replying to mail. So if you want to get some mail back, send it to a kid in elementary school and they will definitely reply. And it's a really great practice for them too. I mean, they're practicing reading and writing and they're also just so excited when they get something in the mail. Maybe all of us are, but the kids show it more.
Sarita, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about letter writing. The people who still do it, a lot of you, it turns out. Susan Shane is with us. She wrote about this in the New York Times. Back to your calls now. Gail is on the line in Stillwater, Minnesota. Gail, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I love to write letters and cards, and often I make my own cards. And I feel like each one is a gift to the person I'm sending it to. So especially if it's family, it's a gift that they can keep. And besides my own words, it's something unique and special. I'll often use like an old paper bag that's got different things on it, or some beautiful paper that I just make into my stationery. And again, it adds interest and uniqueness, and it's my gift.
And Gail, if I can ask, what kind of things do you write? Just kind of keeping in touch. Here's what's going on in your life.
A lot of encouragement, especially to my family, my children, my aunts, just encouragement and love. And I even wrote for 2 years to someone who was in prison who I'd never met. But I got and somebody asked me, would you write this person a Christmas card? And it turned into a 2-year back and forth. We wrote letters back and forth for 2 years. And I saved all of his letters because they were just so special.
Gail, thanks so much for sharing that story. Susan, that's interesting. We've heard from a couple people who wrote to people at a boot camp in one case. In this case, Gail was writing, in addition to family members, to someone in prison. We can kind of seek out someone or an international pen pal. Is that something you've ever done?
It's not something that I've done. I do know David Sedaris did mention that he often writes to people in prison as well. He warned that the addresses are really long, was something that he said. But, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of ways. If you don't feel like you have somebody who you want to write letters to, I did mention a few initiatives in the story. So there's something called More Love Letters, where you can write letters to people who need it. They kind of look through all these different candidates, and then they highlight some candidates and say, here's how you can write letters to them. And then there's Operation Gratitude, where you can write letters to people who are in the military or are first responders. And then, of course, there are programs to write to people in prison as well. So you don't necessarily need to have somebody who you think is going to reply, because there's plenty of people who would absolutely love to get a letter in the mail.
Oh, we heard from Kathleen via email. Kathleen says, I had a pen pal for 48 years. We met through a Northwoods newsletter. We correspond often. I send cards and letters often to others to keep contact and make a point to mail thank you cards. I love that idea, 48-year-long correspondence with basically a stranger she met in the newsletter. You know, pen pals used to be a bigger deal. Should we bring those back, Susan?
I mean, why not? It'd be kind of cool to learn about somebody in a different place and kind of keep track of their life. I mean, I think maybe kids are still doing it in school. I remember we did it when I was younger, but I hope kids are still doing it, because it was really exciting to read about a kid in another state. You know, you have no idea what their lives are like. So it was very cool.
Well, thanks, everyone, for all of your calls. It sounds like if you want to get letters back, write to someone in Wisconsin. And Susan, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Susan Shane is a freelance writer and traveler who's been published in The Washington Post, NPR, and more. She joined us to talk about why and how we can start sending more snail mail. You can read more in her piece for the New York Times called We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now.
And what are you thinking about after hearing Susan and our callers talk about the wonders of handwritten letters and postcards? If you haven't been a letter writer, are you thinking of giving it a try? If you are a regular letter writer, what does it do for you? And what kind of feedback do you get from friends and family on the receiving end? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin Life is launching a new website focused on food traditions in our state. We'll talk with Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Public Radio staff who are involved in the project.
Chef Lydia Bastianich shares some of her family's story of leaving Italy and coming to the United States and what she craves as comfort food this time of year.
We'll explore the concept of social infrastructure and why public spaces like libraries and community centers are so important for health and happiness.
And we'll find out why Americans have turned to advice columns for more than 300 years.
Coming up, we hear from twin eighth grade brothers and their mom about what it's like to change schools and how they adjust it. I'm Judith Sears-Clusson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.